From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, actress Joan Cusack, co-star of such film comedies as Broadcast News, Working Girl, In and Out, and Runaway Bride. She's in the new film High Fidelity, which stars her brother John. Later, we talk with Ted Heller about his new novel Slab Rat, a satire of the magazine world. He's worked for several magazines, including Spy, where he chose many of the photos for the feature Separated at Birth. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Pope John Paul II attended an interfaith dialogue today that turned into a forum for rival Israeli and Palestinian claims to Jerusalem. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports.
In his visit to the Holy Land, the Pope has repeatedly called for reconciliation among all peoples and religions. Today he spoke at an interfaith meeting with Israel's chief rabbi and a Muslim religious leader. The audience was Israelis and Palestinians who were active in interfaith dialogue. The Pope spoke of Jerusalem as a city of peace and said that religion and peace must go together. But the Israeli chief rabbi said that Jerusalem is the eternal capital of the Jewish people. The Muslim sheikh then called Jerusalem the eternal capital of Palestine and left the meeting soon after. Linda Gradstein, NPR News, Jerusalem.
House Speaker Dennis Hastert has chosen a Roman Catholic priest as the new chaplain of the House. Father Daniel Coughlin will be the first Catholic ever to hold the post. Hastert's first choice was Reverend Charles Wright, a Presbyterian minister, but Democrats complained that the House leader showed an anti-Catholic bias by passing over a Catholic priest who'd been recommended for the job. Sources told reporters that Wright volunteered to step aside earlier this week. Hastert denied any bias against Catholics and accused the Democrats of playing what he called an unseemly political game. While relatives of 6-year-old Cuban boy Elian Gonzalez say they'll continue to fight to keep him in America, Attorney General Janet Reno is hinting that time may be running out. NPR's Philip Davis has more from Miami.
Elian's relatives lost a key legal battle this week when a U.S. judge ruled that the attorney general acted within her rights when she decided to agree with the boy's father, who wants his son returned to him in Cuba. Elian's Miami relatives want to keep Elian here while they appeal the ruling, but today Attorney General Janet Reno had this to say.
Under the order of the judge, I have the authority to move him. I am trying to work it out so that this is done in a fair, orderly, and prompt manner.
Cuban-American community leaders say the relatives' lawyers met with immigration officials last night and discussed possible scenarios to return Elian home. Cuban exile leaders say that while things are quiet in Miami now, they're on a state of alert, ready to protest if the government makes a sudden move. Philip Davis, NPR News, Miami.
The House has begun debating a $1.8 trillion Republican spending plan. GOP leaders say their budget proposal would provide more than $200 billion in tax cuts over a 5-year period while making more money available for defense and education. Democrats say the plan fails to protect Social Security or Medicare. In stocks today, the Dow Industrials gained 253 points to close at 11,119. The Nasdaq gained 76 points. This is NPR News from Washington. The Justice Department is conducting a criminal inquiry into computer breakdowns that made it impossible to search White House email files in response to congressional subpoenas. The probe reportedly focuses on whether the White House was really unable to answer the subpoenas because of breakdowns. The administration has acknowledged that thousands of incoming emails could not be searched for information on campaign fundraising and other issues covered by the subpoenas. Vice President Al Gore used a visit to a deteriorating Cincinnati school building today as an example of how Washington should help local school districts with repairs and new construction. Steve Hirschberg of member station WVXU reports.
After touring several classrooms, Gore noted a broken window that had been replaced with a bulletin board and said it's time to make school improvements a top national priority. The vice president is touting a newly introduced bipartisan bill in Congress that would have the federal government pay up to $25 billion in interest on local bonds for school repairs and construction. Gore chided Texas Governor George W. Bush for opposing those Republicans who endorsed the bill.
He disagrees with them on this national effort to build up the school buildings, and derided this sort of approach as what he called bricks and mortar, bricks and mortar. Well, in my book, bricks and mortar are better than smoke and mirrors.
Gore is calling for more teacher hiring, smaller classes, and more training and professional development for teachers. For NPR News, I'm Steve Hirschberg in Cincinnati.
Pakistan's military ruler announced today that the country will hold local elections between next December and May. The White House welcomed the announcement, which comes as President Clinton prepares to visit Pakistan this weekend. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing soy and a variety of soy products to consumers around the world. ADM Supermarket to the world. On the web at admworld.com.
Support for Fresh Air comes from Random House's Delacorte Press Division, publisher of Losing Julia by debut author Jonathan Hull.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is actress Joan Cusack. During her career, she's received Academy Award nominations for her roles in two comedies, Working Girl, in which she played a secretary, and In and Out, in which she played a woman who finds out that her fiancé is secretly gay, a secret he's kept even from himself. In the film Broadcast News, it was Cusack who made the now famous last-minute dash into the control room with the tape clip that needed to get on the air. Cusack has co-starred in several films with her younger brother John Cusack, including Say Anything, Gross Point Blank, and Cradle Will Rock. Now she's in the new movie High Fidelity, based on the popular Nick Hornby novel. The movie stars her brother, John Cusack, as the owner of a used record store who's obsessed with records and with the reasons why his relationships never last. Joan plays his ex-girlfriend's good friend. In this scene, John is at a bar with Joan, hoping to get some advice about how to get his girlfriend back now that she's moved in with a new boyfriend. John's been calling their house a lot.
You have got to stop calling her. You're really upsetting her and him.
I care about him.
Well, you should.
Why?
Because all you're doing is forming a little unit. Them against you. Before you started all this psychotic madness, there was no unit. There was just three people in a mess. But now, they've got something in common, and you don't want to make anything worse.
How could it get any worse than Laura with Ian? Come on, Liz.
Can I ask you a question, and you can think about it if you want to?
Just what is it?
Why do you want Laura back so badly?
Joan Cusack, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
What did you relate to most about the story?
I think I was just so glad that he told a story about a guy's journey to commit to a relationship. I just think that's it. And he really sort of tells all their secrets, I think, in a way. And I just love that I didn't relate to his journey, but I related to the whole struggle of that.
Have you known a lot of guys who wouldn't commit?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think it's a real growth thing. It's like, I mean, he says it in the movie. At some point, you just realize that fantasy doesn't deliver. And it's not that they, guys or people, I mean, I think it's not just guys, too. It's women, too. But at a certain point, you just think, oh, do I have to settle and get deeper and really be who I really am deep down and see who this other person is really deep down? And you know it's not going to be all the flash and really get to the real part of things. And I think that's a hard transition in life.
Had you read the novel before you were cast in the movie?
I hadn't, actually. And so many people have told me since that, you know, God, it was just their favorite book. I don't know how it skipped me, but I read it afterwards.
You read it after you were cast or after you made it?
After I made it.
Why did you wait till afterwards?
Well, I don't know. I think I just thought I wanted to do this script and work on what John was doing. I didn't know if it would change my perception of things.
Did it?
No, not really. I mean, I should have just read it. I don't know. Maybe I was just busy with my son or something.
Now, when your brother makes a movie, do you assume that he'll try to find a role for you in it?
You know, I don't assume it, but I always hope it because I love I love working with him, and I love supporting him because he's always done sort of more leading roles than I've done, and it's just a hard, I think it's a hard job to do that, and it's nice to have people around you to support you, and I just believe in him so much that I'm happy to be there and just be another ear too.
Now, when did you first work together? Did you work together as kids?
Well, he's 4 years younger than me, so, and we grew up doing theater and theater games together in Evanston. But when you're growing up, that's a kind of a big difference. You know, I was going to high school and he was in fifth grade, and then I was leaving high school. So we didn't really ever work together then. But we were in similar theater program in Evanston, right outside of Chicago, that was run by Bernard Joyce Piven, that really kind of shaped the culture of our work. So we had a lot of similar experiences and vocabulary and that kind of stuff.
Tell me a little bit about what this children's theater was like.
It was Byrne and Joyce Piven, who were members originally of the Compass Players, which came out of the University of Chicago, that Mike Nichols and Elaine May were part of, and Ed Asner and Paul Sills. And it was sort of the 60s, and it was very sort of story theater, improvisation, kind of humanistic kind of theater work where you're developing as a human as well as an artist. It wasn't about putting on things. It was more kind of developing from a creative, developing your creativity in performance. And Byrne and Joyce Piven, who were members of that club, just went on to start a theater for kids, which was just so wonderful. And it was just sort of a happenstance thing that my older sister and I did after school, like an after school thing. And I think my dad was always involved creatively and in creative writing. And so there was a real connection there anyway. And we just grew up doing that. Like, I think I was 7 and my sister was 8, and John did it when he got to be, I think, you know, 7 or 8 too. And we did Ray Bradbury stories and J.D. Salinger and Chekhov, and it was just sort of this wonderful little jewel. And, you know, it was just kind of a happenstance thing.
What were some of the ways that the adults around the theater got the children to think about self-transformation into a role?
Well, a lot of it dealt with a story theater technique, which was sort of like you would be telling the story as well as being the character. So you would say, you know, like if you were doing, we did a J.D. Salinger piece, you know, like a Franny and Zoe, and you'd say, and then Franny picked up the phone and cradled it in her hand and spoke to Seymour. And so you were present on stage as a person, which allowed you to be yourself there, I think, philosophically in a way. You weren't like just becoming someone else. You were there and able to then use your feeling to transform into something or into that person. So it was much more accessible, strangely.
As the older sister, and you were 4 years older than John, were you more serious about theater at first, and were you supposed to look out for him?
Yeah, no, not really. I think I was just sort of busy doing it myself. And I think because he was, you know, there was five kids in my family, so everyone was just sort of busy kind of doing their thing. And as soon as he actually started doing it, he was really good. And, you know, I think he started doing commercials in Chicago when he was like 12 or 13. And he started doing professional work kind of right away. So he kind of was launched on his own really, really soon.
What did you think? Were you envious? Or you were actually making movies already yourself?
I had done like a little part in things, but I was in college at the time, and I think I was glad that I was in college. But it was just sort of amazing that he was sort of you know, just sort of taking off that way. And, you know, if you ever meet him, he's such a great Irish politician in a way. It made perfect sense that he was off doing that.
What do you mean by a great Irish politician?
Well, he just, you know, works the room and enjoys it and loves people and loves what he's doing. And he's very extroverted.
Now, your first film role was at the age of 15. You were in My Bodyguard. Describe your part.
Basically, I was just kind of a glorified extra. They were doing this movie, Martin Mull and Ruth Gordon and Chris Makepeace, and it was Tony Bill's movie. I think he had done another one before that, but I just played a kid in the classroom. It was sort of about a boy who takes on the sort of weird, sort of smoldering, who knows what's going on, brooding guy to be his bodyguard. And so it was sort of a classroom kid's story. And so I was one of the other kids in the classroom. And it was nice because I, you know, got the part and I couldn't believe it. And it, just being an extra in it, really. And then we started filming it, and Tony Bill said, you know, you have a nice energy. I think we're going to, you know, maybe, you know, have you do a few scenes with Chris and we'll write a few things for you. Would that be okay with you? And I was like, oh my God, I couldn't believe it.
How did it affect your status in high school to have a small part in a real movie?
I think it just made me feel really good. I think there's like the popular girls were still the popular girls, and it was such a big high school and there were so many cliques and everything that, you know, I think, and it hadn't come out or anything, so no one really knew about it, but I knew about it, and it made me feel sort of special, which was great because I needed all the help I could get in high school.
Now you got in on the John Hughes era of filmmaking. You had a small part in 16 Candles. So tell us about your part in that.
That was, I think at that point, actually, it was like right before I was going to college. And I just had this, you know, silly part in it with my neck brace. But it was great.
Yeah,
was,
just describe the neck brace that you had to wear.
It was a neck brace, and I think it hooked onto my braces. Or no, I don't think it did, actually. It was just sort of like if you were in a car accident kind of neck brace that you just have to keep your neck still. And then it sort of goes over your shoulder, so it just sort of stabilizes you. And thus the comedy ensues.
So you had made at least two movies before you even got out of high school. Did that make you think, like, I got to do this, I got to keep doing this?
I think it was certainly encouraging. And actually now, you know, I realize how crucial that is to have experiences when you're younger that give you confidence. Because it's such a hard job to stay confident in, because you don't have consistent work. And you can see when you go to an audition, you can see there's so many talented people. And how do you at that moment just feel like you can really do it?
You went to college. You went to the University of Wisconsin at Madison.
Uh-huh.
Did your parents insist that you go to college instead of just trying to go to Hollywood right away? Or was that your idea?
They definitely supported going to college. They both had great experiences at their college. And the argument they said to me was that if you want to be an actor your whole life, you can. But this is a chance to learn about all the other parts of the world and all the other kinds of things that are going on. And, you know, the great reading great Russian novels and learning about character from another point of view. And, you know, you'll always have that education. And you can't, it's just so powerful.
Were they right?
I think so. I mean, I think obviously if you're Uta Hagen and you're studying acting as deeply as she does, you have that training of depth. But sometimes if you're just doing acting, you know, life upon life, or just feeling like once removed from life and studying that too long, I think you can, or I feel anyway, that you lose something, that having that background of just life itself as the most important thing and the most diverse thing really was powerful to me.
My guest is actress Joan Cusack. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Joan Cusack, and she co-stars in the new movie High Fidelity, which stars her brother John Cusack. In 1985 to 86, you were a cast member of Saturday Night Live. And were you out of college yet when you started
yeah.
doing this? You were out of
mm-hmm.
college? How
mm-hmm.
long out of college?
I actually had just gotten out of college.
So who else was in the cast with you during your year on Saturday Night Live?
Let's see, Nora Dunn and John Lovitz and Dennis Miller and Robert Downey Jr. and Randy Quaid and Denitra Vance and Damon Wayans.
You know, it's funny. It's really a terrific group of actors, and yet it's hardly considered one of the high points in the history of Saturday Night Live. I wonder why that is.
I don't think anyone watched it that year at all. And you know, it was they were going to cancel the show actually mm-hmm. that year, and Lorne Michaels at the last minute decided to come back, and I think maybe they had 2 months to kind of get everything together, and they sort of went with more sort of actory type people than comedians, I think was part of their thinking, but no one kind of got a chance to sort of get to know each other mm-hmm. that much beforehand, I think, and it was all so fast, and suddenly you were, you know, doing this live show, and so I don't know if that was part of it too.
Did you write any of your own sketches?
No, I never sort of worked that way before. It was always sort of I had done improv and theater, and you know, suddenly I was in like an office building with typewriters, and I was like, how do you do this? And, you know, a lot of it was like sort of like socializing and trying to figure out what you could do and getting to know the writers and seeing if you had similar sense of humor, and they'd come up with an idea and you could think, you know, if you could do that or make that work. Or, I mean, I sort of felt like I had, you know, nicely, I had those little bits of confidence that I felt like, you know, if someone wrote something, I could make it work or I could try to make it work. And so I kind of relied on that.
So did you have to compete for parts or lobby the writers for good parts?
That was sort of part of it, I think. It was a really, really competitive place. And the writers were all trying to compete to get their stuff on. And I think that I wasn't sort of, I know I was competitive and driven, but I just didn't feel it quite that aggressive. I wasn't that good at being aggressive in that way, I don't think.
Is that why you left after one season?
Well, yeah, I think. I mean, that and they fired me.
Oh, oh, that.
I like to think it was some choice I made. No, it wasn't working. And it wasn't working for me, too. I was miserable. I think I wound up in the hospital, actually, and I had, like, some surgery and... It's like horrible.
Did they operate on your stress glands or something?
Yeah. Yeah. No, but it's, you know, I'm so grateful that I was on that show. Because, again, it was like, God, to have done that, you just have a little bit more confidence to do things. Even if it didn't go well. I felt so badly about it that I didn't make it on that show and it wasn't right for me, you know, that how could it, you know, I loved Gilda Radner and how could it have not worked out? And then I realized it wasn't the right environment for me, you know, that I was better doing theater stuff or just straight acting stuff.
Well, it certainly helped establish your identity as a comic actress. Yeah. Is that the identity you wanted, or did you want more dramatic parts too?
You know, I'd grown up doing both, but I sort of had always, you know, in our house, sort of comedy was a really important value. We grew up watching Mel Brooks movies and Monty Python and Fernwood Tonight and Mary Hartman. And, you know, my dad always played the producers in the backyard every summer. And
oh, great.
It was just like that was part of an important value that they were trying to pass on as comedy. So I think that was always in my heart. But, you know, I liked doing, you know, like diverse thing. I liked doing theater and more serious things, too.
Joan Cusack will be back in the second half of the show. Here's a scene from the comedy In and Out, for which she received an Academy Award nomination. It's her wedding night, but the wedding has been called off because the groom has just admitted he's gay. She's drinking in a bar, wearing her wedding dress, talking with a tabloid reporter played by Tom Selleck. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Will you sleep with me?
What?
3 years!
Oh, my God.
3 years of sunsets and long talks and loving, supportive friendship.
God.
This is my wedding night! I'm there! I'm ready! This is a medical condition!
Gee, thank you. But, I can't.
What, are you married? Are you seeing someone? I don't care!
Well, no, I...
You're a man! I'm a woman!
I'm gay.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873, online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. By Time. This week, Time magazine reports on how inexpensive technology, fast internet connections, and free time are allowing people to create their own entertainment websites. By Garden.com, an online source for gardening advice and home delivery of a variety of seeds, plants, home furnishings, tools, and other gardening products. And Random House and its Bantam Books division, publisher of Bones of the Master, A Buddhist Monk's Search for the Lost Heart of China by George Crane. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more with actress Joan Cusack, and we'll talk with writer Ted Heller about his new novel, Slab Rat. It's a satire of the magazine publishing world, a place Heller is familiar with, having worked at Spy, Details, Vanity Fair, and Premiere. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with actress Joan Cusack. She's in the new movie High Fidelity, which stars her brother, John Cusack. Her other films include Runaway Bride, In and Out, Working Girl, Say Anything, and Broadcast News. Let me ask you about one of the comic scenes that you're best known for, and this is the scene in Broadcast News in which you're the person who has to run down the hall from the office into the control room, delivering the video clips just a moment before it is due to be broadcast. Tell us how that scene was shot.
That actually is one of my favorite things I've ever done, that movie. I just think it's such a great film. But they shot it in lots of different pieces. And so it was like sort of a running, not running gag, but a running scene that we were shooting all through the film. There was maybe 7 or 8 pieces of it that we did at different times. And it was, and at the end of it, I remember they gave me a huge, one of those horseshoe wreaths, like horses get at the end of a race. It was so cute and sweet.
We have a minute and a half. It's my responsibility to tell the control room and New York that we won't be ready.
We'll be ready.
In 84 seconds.
15 seconds.
Oh, God. You're saying, oh, God.
Lay it in, Bobby. Back out.
They're going to go up and the screen will be black, and they're going to go to black because we're not there. What about careers, huh? We're not going to make it.
Whoops.
Whoops.
What was the trickiest part for you in that scene?
I think there was a part where they wanted me to slide under this filing cabinet, and they actually had like a stunt guy like helping me, and they sprayed silicone on the floor, and I had and like newspapers, and I had like knee pads on. They wanted me to get really close to the filing cabinet, and I remember the stunt guy at the time was kind of out there, like a little Hollywoody, and he was like, "You've got to be the cabinet and then be underneath the cabinet," and I don't know what he was saying, but whatever. I just was like, "All right, I'll just try that." And anyway, I think I got really close to the cabinet, so that it was a little scary, actually. But it was, like my head did, like I almost hit it.
You got an Academy Award nomination for your role in Working Girl.
Mm-hmm.
You and Melanie Griffith played secretaries, and she is, through all these, mistaken identity things, ends up becoming
executive.
Executive, thank you, the word I was looking for. And so, particularly early in the movie, you both have really big hair.
Yeah.
How did you like yourself in this real teased high hair?
Well, I feel that it was like my kabuki performance. But honestly, the guy that did it, Roy Helland, he was the makeup and hair artist who'd worked with Liv Ullmann for years and years and years. And he was a fascinating makeup art and hair artist. And he did the cool, it was such a, I know the secretaries on the Staten Island Ferry had 20 minutes from going from Staten Island to Manhattan, and everyone was jammed in the bathroom, and we actually went and took the ferry, when at work time, teasing their hair. And so it was a do you could do in 20 minutes. They all came in just with their, having showered and did their makeup and hair on the boat. And he just turned it into such a craft. He actually like bleached the bottom of my hair just a tiny little bit, so it just looked like it was fried, not like it was, a color that had grown out, but actually just fried hair. And then, I think now, about doing that. I'm just so grateful he was so good. Because it was really just totally enhanced. The character was the whole, you know, I barely had to do anything, and it was funny.
In the recent film Runaway Bride, you were Julia Roberts' friend. You've played a bunch of best friend kind of parts. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if you like Eve Arden and the kind of prototypical best friend actors.
Yeah. I think Eve Arden did some great performances, really. And I actually have come to really like the best friend role. At first, I think because I did it in Working Girl 2 and I've done it before. And in Runaway Bride, I thought it wasn't really worth it for me to do it again unless I could sort of make it meaningful for myself in some way. Mm-hmm. And really say, wait a minute, if I'm going to be the best friend, I want to be what a best friend really is, and like really say something to my friend that a best friend would say, or behave in a way that was meaningful in that way. And in that way, the part became meaningful to me. I think, you know, in general, I've played a lot of character parts. And I found that to be a great kind of wonderful life as an actor, because, you know, and I know it especially from John, because he's always done kind of leading roles, that there's such a pressure on you, and it's such a demanding schedule. And there's something wonderful about being able to go in and do your part and show up and support the film and be part of the story and not have to carry the whole thing and then go home and, you know, be a leading lady in your real life. I've been really kind of grateful for those parts. They've really fit my life really nicely.
You know, for someone who's played the best friend in several films, I wonder if you have a best friend in real life, if you have time for friends in real life. You are the mother of two, I think. You're married. You have your film career. Do you have time for friends?
Yeah, I think, you know, and I love that about the kind of parts I've been able to have, that I do have time for that. And I've been able to, I think, live in Chicago and concentrate on having a marriage that works, that I try hard to make work, and a family. I'm actually 8 months pregnant.
Oh.
Yeah.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
This is your third?
It's my second, actually.
Oh.
But have friends and family and a social life and a culture and be part of a community, because, you know, as I just feel like those are the things that ultimately are the most meaningful. You know, that the extraordinary things in life are the ordinary things in life. I know that saying always sticks with me, because I just find it to be so true. And I mean, what would you do without your friends in life? It just, and I'm you know, it's easy for me to say I've had a great career and been able to make some money, but I mean it sincerely, that it just doesn't, I just haven't found those things to be, you know, it's nothing like coming home and getting a hug from my son. It's just not that. It's just so much more powerful.
When you realized that a lot of Hollywood was going to be about how much do you weigh and how beautiful are you, did you feel in a way like you were back in high school and the popular kids were ruling the world?
Right. It is like that. It's kind of a very, I mean, I don't mean to be judgmental. It's just for me anyway, I think. It's just a very, you know, juvenile kind of thinking, ultimately. You know, it's not very sophisticated. and Hollywood is more than that. I think there's incredibly creative, talented people there, and, you know, lots of, especially, well, not now. I mean, I think there's always been amazing women doing amazing things out there, and men, and you just have to find them. But if your mindset is stuck feeling like you've got to fit into this perfect world and have everything look perfect. You just, it's just never-ending failure.
I want to wish you good luck with your new baby.
Oh, thank you.
And will you stop working for a while until...
I'm actually going to do a sitcom with Jim Brooks in Chicago, starting probably the mid-season replacement. Yeah, and that it's great because...
So you can stay home and work.
So I'm going to stay, I get to stay, live and work in the same place and have a kind of a very structured, sort of stable working life and have a family. And I'm so, I mean, I'm so lucky and thrilled and happy that Jim Brooks is willing to come to Chicago and work a little bit because he's going to do it in Chicago.
And Jim Brooks did the Mary Tyler Moore Show and Broadcast News, in which you co-starred. So what's the sitcom going to be about?
It's actually based on this woman, Gwen Macsai, who's done pieces for NPR. It's kind of based on her life, and it's about being heroic, I think, in a marriage and sort of trying to shrug off neurosis. And she has a book that just came out, Lipstick, that's really great. That sort of has the feel of her humor. And she's really... And Jim Brooks heard her on NPR and her little pieces and sort of contacted her, I think, 5 years ago. And I had contacted him probably 5 or 6 years ago, too, about trying to do a sitcom. And he said, oh, well, there's serendipity to these things, and which wasn't what I wanted to hear at the time. But now it's really great because she's come along and written quite a bit now and is really going to write the show and lives in Chicago. And it's really, really exciting.
Well, I wish you the best, and I thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, it's just a pleasure.
Joan Cusack is in the new film High Fidelity, which opens next week. It stars her brother, John Cusack. He'll be our guest next week. Coming up, Ted Heller, author of the new novel Slab Rat, a satire of the magazine industry. This is Fresh Air. Ted Heller's first novel, Slab Rat, is set in the world of magazine publishing. The novel satirizes the contents of glossy magazines and the office politics of the writers and editors. Heller is familiar with that world. He's worked at Vanity Fair, Details, Premiere, and Spy, mostly in the photography departments. Heller is the son of writer Joseph Heller, best known for the novel Catch-22. Slab Rat's main character, Alan Post, is an assistant editor at It Magazine, part of the magazine empire controlled by Versailles Publishing. In order to fit in at the magazine, he's made up a fake upper-class background. Now he has to figure out a way to advance up the magazine's corporate ladder. Here's a reading about his working life before It Magazine when he worked at Here Magazine.
It's true that I worked at Here for a while, and it was boring. Mind-numbingly, lethally boring. Except for the fact that I was constantly on my toes, lest someone discover that I didn't really belong there. The only thing lower than wasting away at Here is working for Versailles' sister publication company, Federated Magazines, which puts out magazines for boy group obsessed teens, Teen Time, gun enthusiasts, Bullet and Barrel, and people waiting in salons to get a haircut, dues. They're in another building, and I think that building might be in another city. Nobody ever talks about them. It's a superstition. I don't even want to mention them. My boss at Here was a 60-year-old French woman named Jean Leclerc. She had painted on yellow eyebrows that resembled the McDonald's arches. At Here, I did things. I read things, opened things, wrote little things, passed things along, and collected the biggest paychecks I'd ever seen up to then. Here, though, is where you either begin or end up. But being transferred there is so ignominious that usually you just quit instead. It's like being a baseball manager for 20 years and then finding yourself a first base coach.
That's Ted Heller reading from his new novel, Slab Rat. Now, what jobs have you actually had at magazines?
Well, let's see. I started at Spy magazine, and I was brought in there not permanently. Do you remember? I don't know if you remember the Andy Warhol diaries. That's what it was. It was Andy Warhol's diaries, and they were very gossipy. As a matter of fact, that's the only thing they were. But they did not have an index, and there were hundreds and hundreds of names there. So they needed people to just read the book many times over, and every single time a famous name was mentioned, to write it down and write, you know, why that person was being mentioned. And that was my first job in magazines. So I would write things like Halston, cocaine use of, things like that. dozens and dozens of things like that. So that was my first job. And then after that, I got work at Spy magazine, and I don't know if you remember Separated at Birth.
Yes, that was very funny. Describe it.
Well, you took two famous people who resembled each other and paired them up. And so I did that for a couple of years. And I still have residual after effects of it. Whenever I see a picture of Jeff Bridges, I think of, there's an Iranian cleric named, I don't know his first name, and I wouldn't be able to pronounce it if I did, but his last name is Rafsanjani. And whenever I see Rafsanjani, I think of Jeff Bridges and vice versa.
What's the closest you came to working at a magazine like It magazine?
Well, I worked at Spy for maybe 3 or 4 years, and then I was laid off with other people. I don't really know the order of magazines that I worked at, but I did work at Vanity Fair for 2 weeks. I was filling in for somebody, and I worked in the photo department, and I basically returned photos. It was entirely a clerical job. Tina Brown was the editor-in-chief at that time, not Graydon Carter, who's the editor-in-chief now. And I just remember walking the hallways and nobody acknowledging my existence, nobody saying hello or anything like that.
Now, your main character, in order to get his job at the magazine, he fakes his resume, and he even makes up a well-bred path for himself because he wants to fit into his perception of this world. Mm-hmm. So he tells people that he's from a wealthy community and that his father is a brilliant but temperamental architect, when in fact his real father owns a couple of swimming pool supply stores named The Wet Guy. And I'm wondering why you related to this need to rewrite your life when, in a way, I mean, you already came from a pedigree. You're the son of the writer Joseph Heller, most famous for Catch-22.
There were some things that I did relate to him to, and that was in terms of frustration at his job. But there's really not that much of this book, which is too autobiographical.
When you were growing up and when mm-hmm. you were first starting to work, how did you feel about it when people would find out who your father was?
The weird thing is, it often happens that people found out about it before I met them. For instance, I found out recently that the job interview I had at Nickelodeon Magazine, where I work now, the woman, I only found this out recently, had been told who my father was before I even had the interview. So things like that happen, and it's a little disconcerting, and after 43 years, I now know to keep my antenna up most of the time.
What's disconcerting about it?
Just the fact that it's like I sort of have a reputation, but it's not even my reputation.
Right. Now, you're 43 now. First mm-hmm. novel just published. It's kind of late for a first novel.
Well, it's the first published novel. You should see what I've got underneath my bed. Other than the dust bunnies, there are lots of books, plays, movies there. Uh-huh. So I tried.
Did you ever get so discouraged that you were threatening to permanently give up?
Well, by the time I started writing Slab Rat, the weird thing was I had given up. When I was writing this, I had no thought that this book would ever get published. I was really writing for me. And if this hadn't gotten published, I would have written another book, and I would have written that one for me. And by this time, by the time that I had finished Slab Rat, I contacted agents, sending query letters to them, almost on a lark, thinking, well, maybe this one will get published. And it did. And I'm still in a state of shock.
My guest is Ted Heller, author of the new novel Slab Rat. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Ted Haller, and his new novel, Slab Rat, is a satire of the magazine world. So let's talk about some of the day jobs that you had over the years. You worked in the garment district for a while?
Yes, I did.
What did you do there?
I did anything that anyone asked me to. I pushed racks full of clothing. I unloaded trucks. I loaded trucks. I did shelving, which is taking the clothing out of boxes and put them on the shelves by size and color, that kind of stuff. And I liked the job. My best friend was my boss. As a matter of fact, that's how I got the job. He was the warehouse manager.
Awesome.
And I liked the people I worked with. It was totally stress-free. I really enjoyed it.
Uh-huh. Now, a lot of people get their identities, or at least partially get their identities from their work. And you were doing work that you were doing to tide you over while you tried to write.
Mm-hmm.
Did that affect your sense of who you were?
Well, when I was working in the clothing business, I was just, I was not really trying to write until I saw the play Glengarry Glen Ross. And I saw that on a date. And I remember the next day, I just loved the play. And the next day, I told my boss, you got to go see this play. He went. I don't know if he went on a date, though. He might have gone alone. And we just turned on our word processor. And this was a while ago, so the word processors don't look like they do today. We just started writing a play. And that was like the first real writing that I had ever done. And somehow, I don't know how, but the play got a workshop production in Los Angeles. So when that was really when I started writing.
So if it wasn't for that, you wouldn't have started.
I owe it all to David Mamet. It's very strange because a couple of weeks ago, I was at my job. I was on the floor, and there were hundreds and hundreds of 35mm slides, and I'm sorting them and doing this and that with them. And the phone rang, and I picked it up, and it was Gregory Mosher, who directed Glengarry Glen Ross. He had read Slab Rat, and he was calling me because he liked it so much. And we just started doing lines from Glengarry Glen Ross to each other over the phone. And it was kind of sad, because then I had to say goodbye, and then I was back on the floor, and I was sorting through pictures of the Backstreet Boys and NSYNC again.
For your magazine.
Yes.
and we should say that Glengarry Glen Ross, it's a play by David Mamet about guys who work for this kind of scam real estate company mm-hmm. that sells, like, bad real estate to unknowing people by phone, and mm-hmm. they try to pass it off as this wonderful, wonderful economic opportunity. What was your take on that? I mean, how did your play connect to that subject?
It was really the language that they were using. That's what staggered me, because for months and months, my friend and I, we would just do dialogue to each other like that. Imitating people who worked in the clothing business, the older Jewish men, the younger black men, Hispanic men, the Italian people. We just would just do that with each other all the time. And then we saw that, hey, you can do this and get paid for it and win a Tony for it. So we thought, okay, let's give this a try.
Do you remember some of the lines from your play?
You embarrass me, Terry.
That's what they paid me the big bucks for.
Okay, all right. This is why I do not understand why this play, I don't even understand why anyone read more than 4 pages of it. Because the first 3 pages were just two Jewish guys in their 70s arguing who is a better ball player, Willie Mays and Ty Cobb. And they just, I think the first 3 pages were just, if you read it, it would be like Mays, pause, Cobb, long pause. We had also been reading a lot of Harold Pinter then. So I think there were more pauses than words on the first couple of pages. And I'm baffled by the fact that anybody actually read more than that.
Did your father encourage you to write?
There was never any pressure at all, none whatsoever. I remember when I told him about that play, as a matter of fact, the name of that play was Damaged Goods. He was shocked because I had never told him that I, you know, had been trying to write. He was pleasantly shocked, I'll add.
Are you sorry that he didn't live to actually see the book's publication?
That is perhaps the most unfair thing that has ever happened to me. He died on December 12th, and I think 2 weeks later, a messenger came to me at work and delivered the book to me. And that was just, I'm not married, I don't have any kids, so this was like maybe the biggest moment in my life, and I couldn't tell him about it. That was very bad.
Yeah. You know, your novel satirizes the magazine world, many magazines. And now I imagine you're being written up in some of those magazines. So what's the experience like of being praised in magazines that you've satirized in the book that you're being praised for in those magazines?
I remember when I told my ex-girlfriend that I was going to be photographed by Vanity Fair. And I think she said, haven't they read the book? And that was sort of my attitude, too. Like, I couldn't believe that they were doing that.
Ted Heller, he's the author of the new novel, Slab Rat. Fresh Air's senior producer today was Roberta Chirac. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Naomi Person, Amy Salad, and Phyllis Myers, with Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, and Patty Leswing. Research assistance from Brendan Noonan. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Lawyers.com, an online legal resource for identifying and hiring a lawyer. AOL keyword, Lawyers.com. From Reel.com, an online source for movies, offering over 100,000 titles on VHS and DVD. On the web at REEL.com. AOL keyword, REEL. And from Random House's Crown Division, publisher of The Gilded Dinosaur, The Fossil War Between E.D. Cope and O.C. Marsh, and The Rise of the American Science by Mark Jaffe. This is NPR, National Public Radio. On the next archive edition of Fresh Air, we mark the 20th anniversary of Nightline by listening back to an interview with Ted Koppel. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.